Lars asked me to talk about outcomes of mergers, and I warned him that this was an invitation to rampant speculation, which is a promise I intended to deliver on here. Okay. I've got no screen display down here. Okay, well, let's see here. Well, that's the wrong. No, it wasn't. Okay. Okay, back to the beginning. Okay, just in a broad outline, I intend to follow a progression here from hard fact to utter speculation, or if you will, from truth to truthiness, as the case may be. But I want to take you through the different steps in the merger of a white dwarf. Some of these we have within limits a reasonably robust physical picture for, but as you'll see as we progress, there are a number of loose ends that appear in the process. You all know that if we can form double white dwarfs and they don't do anything else, their orbits will decay by gravitational radiation. There's a well-known formula here. I've cast these things in terms of the white dwarf or the chirp mass, which is something that LISA would detect in a gravitational wave experiment, and the orbital period in minutes, and the time scale, minutes taken as a typical time scale for double white dwarfs as they enter the interactive stage. And in fact, down here is a rough expression for the orbital period of a white dwarf of mass M normalized to the Chandrasekhar mass. You can see, as we all know, those periods are extremely short. Right away, we run into a problem. As you saw in the previous slide, the evolutionary time scale, the in-spiraling time scale, as one approaches mass transfer, gets down to a human time scale, something of the order of 100 years. If the white dwarfs were to remain synchronously, that implies an enormous rate of input of rotational energy. And in principle, that can alter the initial phases of mass transfer altogether. What I'm going to describe on subsequent slides has to do with completely degenerate donor stars transferring to completely degenerate companions. But the input of energy, or at least the potential input of energy from tides, from rotation, from, if you will, mode coupling, is sufficiently high that it could lead actually to a fairly luminous system. Models by Eben and co-workers give luminosities of the order of 10 to the 2 L sun, to 10 to the 3 L sun for systems as they approach mass transfer. That high dissipation rate is concentrated, of course, because the tides are strongest near the surface of the donor star, is concentrated in its outer layer. As I say, it can easily lead to quite high luminosities for the donor, but one needs to bear in mind that the total amount of energy available is not sufficient to lift the degeneracy of that star altogether. So it may affect the initial mass transfer rates. I don't think it's going to make a lot of difference to the outcome of the merger process. Now, as Stirl reviewed in much more sophisticated terms than I here, there are basically the basic issue in determining whether a merging white dwarf is dynamically stable, goes through relatively slow mass transfer from donor to accretor. Mind you, slow is in terms of this 100-year human time scale, that's the orbital evolution time scale due to gravitational radiation when they reach interaction. Dynamical stability requires that as the donor loses mass, its radius decreases more rapidly than its Roeschlau. These zetas here are the logarithmic derivatives, if you will, of the radius of the white dwarf with respect to its mass. That's zeta WD and zeta L, the logarithmic derivative of the Roeschlau radius with respect to mass. What precise numerical values those two parameters assume depend in detail on how you manage the angular momentum budget during mass transfer. But there certainly exist two regimes. Here on this plot we have just the for classical strictly conservative mass transfer, the exponent for the Roeschlau and the exponent for the white dwarf. This is the region below this mass. Mu here is in the case of the Roeschlau, the fraction of the mass of the system contained in the donor. And in the case of the white dwarf, it's the mass of the donor white dwarf in units of the Chandrasekhar mass. So where those two cross, if we had a Chandrasekhar mass accretor, this intersection would define the largest mass stable donor in an interacting binary system. And that turns out to be about 2/3 of a solar mass, again, in this classical case. So any white dwarf more than about 2/3 of a solar mass is prone to be dynamically unstable when it reaches its Roeschlau. It's prone to have the mass transfer rate blow up. Now we can actually solve for what that mass transfer rate is under simple assumptions. It's some function, some dimensionless function of the mass ratio donor to accretor, some other dimensionless function of the mass of the donor in terms of the Chandrasekhar limit. Both of those are of order unity or 10, thereabouts, the ratio of the mean molecular weight of the donor star's envelope to its interior mean electron mean molecular weight. The operative parts of this expression sit right here. Dimensionally, the mass transfer rates you expect from a lobe-filling white dwarf are of the order of the mass of the white dwarf divided by the orbital period. That is, if mass transfer is unstable, once the degree of lobe-filling becomes large, that's the characteristic time scale on which mass transfer will occur. It's of the order of the orbital time scale, solar masses per minute. And you see down here with some manipulation, we can put this expression in terms of the mass of the donor. And we can solve that equation, at least for the initial phases of mass transfer, if we assume that the radius excess, that delta R, which is the radius of the donor, minus the radius of the Roeschlau over the radius of the donor, is small and is simply proportional to the amount of mass that's been transferred and then some driving term due to gravitational radiation, you get two families of solutions. One which is stable, indicated here by the solid line, mass transfer rate rises initially as the angular momentum loss in the case at hand, given by that gravitational radiation timescale, drives the system into interaction, and it stabilizes at a characteristic mass transfer rate given by the expression in the upper right hand corner. So mass transfer rates in that case of the order of solar masses per 100 or 1,000 years, as the case may be, but extremely high mass transfer rates by the standards of other venues for binary star evolution. And the time scale down here, never mind all these dimensionless factors, goes roughly as the square of the cube root of tau squared times p. That's some growth time scale which is of the order typically of a year or some significant fraction of a year. So in the early phases when a star first fills its Roeschlau at t star equals zero here and rises rapidly for a few years, the mass transfer is driven entirely by the orbital decay, And then the response of the donor to mass loss will either carry it off, on the stable branch here, or in the opposite case, when this difference flips sign onto the dynamically unstable branch. I'm going to skip that one. It's ancient history, but it was merely to point out that we encounter both varieties of mass transfer, stable and unstable, for suitable combinations of carbon, oxygen, and helium white dwarfs. Now, how do I get this thing started? I'm sorry? Well, there's mouse, but there's no cursor. Okay, whoops. There we go. So here is the state of the art in merger calculations, as it were. There's a calculation to Guerrero et al. And what you can see is that indeed, I should remark, this is only slightly faster than real time. T on the left in orbital periods is that very quickly, within 10 orbital periods, the donor star is completely disrupted here into a massive circumstellar disk. Now, one of the issues that we want to address in the context of whether these are viable supernova progenitors is, what's the degree of internal heating in the accreting white dwarf? And secondly, is the degeneracy of the donor completely lifted in the process? So here's a, now where did my cursor go? Oops. There we go. Ah. Nope. I had a sense of impending disaster prior to this. In nearly real time, yeah. Ah, that's a point we'll come to momentarily here. End of the slideshow, click to exit. This will be entertaining to all the people who watch the video of this talk, won't it? This is meant to be. Okay, there we go. Now, don't blink or you miss it. An estimate of the degree of heating of the accreting white dwarf and of the accreted material. What you see is basically the base of the accreted white dwarf reaching temperatures which can momentarily ignite. In this case, this is a 0.8 plus 1 solar mass pair of carbon-oxygen white dwarfs. In the initial phase of the mass transfer, the temperature at the base of the accreted layer can momentarily reach carbon ignition temperatures. What Guerrero et al. Find is that that is quickly quenched by the expansion. This is a 3D calculation expansion of that layer, and we are left with the accreting white dwarf and the companion now disrupted into a massive disk. This is an SPH calculation, obviously. Wolfgang, I think, is attempting to do this on an adaptive mesh. There's a group at Louisiana, as we heard in the last talk, also working on adaptive mesh calculations. There are serious limitations in the SPH approach first of all, in the high artificial viscosity or high numerical viscosity that's typical of the technique, but also difficulty in resolving the shock front, the accretion shock front. Let me take a giant leap now to what was meant to be the punchline of this talk. Jim asked about what fraction of the material is lost in these mergers. The SPH calculations are fairly consistent in showing that the initial phase of mass transfer, initial phase of disruption of the donor white dwarf throws out a tidal tail that absorbs some significant fraction of the angular momentum of the binary, but not enough to prevent the remainder of that donor dissolving into a massive disk. Very little mass is actually lost from the system in these cases, somewhere of the order of a percent or two. What I can't find in any of the published descriptions is just how much angular momentum that is taking away. The typical boundaries for the calculation are at a few times the initial orbital separation. At that boundary, the angular momentum content of the material that's lost is probably only a few percent, three or four times the fraction of mass lost from the system. A more telling question is whether it's necessarily the case that the degeneracy of a donor star is lifted in the process. Now, the calculations that have been done so far have been entirely disparate mass ratios. And I would encourage the people who are in a position to actually calculate mergers to look at the case of an equal mass system. The virial theorem tells you that where the shock and the accretion shock forms, it can't be a strong shock if the dimensions of the two stars are comparable or not for the deep interiors. And so there's a question in my mind anyway of whether the donor star, the degeneracy of the donor star, is necessarily lifted in the merger process. Lost my train of thought. There's an additional, or thirdly, I'll come back to secondly when I think of it. Thirdly, there's a question of what physical process is responsible for removing the angular momentum of this massive circumstellar disk. I should remark, and I will ask Lev to vouch for it, Kais, Philip, in the context of people who do binary star evolution, the creation of close double white dwarfs is a logical imperative. It's virtually impossible to avoid the situation where a large fraction of any initial binary population ends up as close double white dwarfs. And so the question is, if they don't become type 1 supernovae, what do they become? What do they look like in this case where we have a massive circumstellar disk? How long lived is that disk? What are the physical processes responsible for its dissipation? And I can think of several possible explanations for that. One, you form a non-degenerate envelope from the initially shocked accretion stream. That acts as a dissipative medium, just as in common envelope evolution, to remove angular momentum from the embedded disk. I can't say I find that a particularly attractive picture. Alternatively, magnetorotational instabilities could be responsible for extracting angular momentum from the disk. And I'm sure those are not the only possibilities that exist. What does seem worrisome in the process is one still has a lot of rotational energy stored in the disk that one has to remove, hopefully by mechanical means, because if you do it by radiative means, then you will certainly lift the degeneracy of that disk. So the question from the standpoint of type 1 supernovae is the degeneracy of the donor lifted? If not, does ignition truly occur on the merger timescale itself and not on some timescale characterizing the dissipation of this heavy disk? If the heavy disks are common and persistent, what do they look like? If the net accretion rate from the disk onto the central white dwarf is the order is Eddington limited, for example, the disk should persist for 10 to the 5 years. That's a short time scale, but they should also then be extremely luminous objects. And to my knowledge, we have no prospective counterpart for them. And finally, I will simply say that I haven't addressed the issue of carbon oxygen plus helium white dwarfs, but my sense, and I am not in the inner circle on this account, my sense is from the people who do extreme helium stars or our Corona Borealis stars, that this has now become the favored mechanism for the formation of those objects. And so they evidently solve this massive disk problem and become visible objects. So I'll stop there.
Just a clarification, what you said about these Corona Borealis stars. So could you elaborate a little on how you think they were formed? They are helium-burning helium stars?
The notion is that they form, and these are, yes, they're helium stars, presumably apparently with carbon-oxygen cores. And the question, there are basically two classes models. One, merged double degenerates, in which a helium donor is disrupted onto a carbon-oxygen core. The alternative popular model, I think, is that these are single stars in a final helium flash. Now, it's my understanding that all of these sit in sort of the G, F to G spectral type, or temperature range, I should say. They're very luminous systems. Copious dust producers, and so there are these two families of models, the difference being that the merged systems are much longer lived than the final helium pulse objects. And I think that and the fact that spectroscopic observations recently revealed anomalous isotope ratios in the envelopes of those stars have biased the conventional wisdom towards merged degenerates. I don't understand the details enough to pass judgment on that, but certainly we do expect helium plus CO white dwarf pairs. They do merge. They become something. Helium's relatively easy to ignite.
Yeah, Jack's question, comment. On this extreme helium stars and Erka Boas, I think the accepted picture is that most of them are mergers. Some are post-late helium flash stars or whatever. And yes, because the lifetime of the post-helium flash stars is too short, you need the mergers. I think the picture is if you have a merger of a helium star and a carbon star, white dwarf, helium white dwarf, carbon white dwarf, you get something which is some sort of Erka Boas as well, maybe different chemical composition. But I'm not sure it solves the heavy disk problem, because I think this is a phase after the merger, after the disk has settled on becoming a new star. So I'm not sure this heavy disk problem is solved for these stars as well.
No, I would merely argue that the stars have solved it.
Agreed.
This may just be a technical detail, but when these, if you disrupt this thing and make this heavy disk you're talking about around there, that doesn't correspond to the density structure of an alpha-like disk, I presume. It's got whatever it's got. So you bring in some kind of alpha-like viscosity or the MRI or something, then it's going to rearrange itself into a different density structure on some kind of viscous time scale, I guess. Is that a potentially significant phase in this, or observational consequences?
Well, it's certainly potentially significant phase in this. Something dissipates those disks, because the argument with the Arcor-Bohr system is, if indeed those are post-merger systems, the disks have dissipated, and we don't know the mechanism. I come back to the same issue, that from a binary evolution standpoint, it's next to impossible to avoid creating a huge number of close double white dwarfs. They merge. The SPH calculations point clearly to the disruption of a secondary into some massive disk. What do those systems look like? I mean, they don't have long lifetimes, but they're comparable, for example, to planetary nebula lifetimes, and they are very luminous objects. Why can't we identify them?
So let's take the prerogative of having the microphone. So Ken Nemoto and Eben had these papers from the 80s showing that, of course, if you're creating at a time scale faster than the thermal time, so 10 to the minus 6 solar masses per year or above, you don't need to put any entropy into the white dwarf. You just compress the outer layer, and that's where the ignition starts. So I think that part, from my understanding, hasn't changed. So,
well, it's changed to the extent that the 3D calculations, the expansion, meridional expansion, if you will, seem to quench that ignition. I don't know. Maybe Ken has.
Yeah. So maybe Ken. I'm trying to provoke Ken.
I think Philip will show tomorrow, and when they end, one of my colleagues also tried the SPH simulations, and so after merging, the structure looks quite stationary for a few minutes. Mm-hmm. So in that case, we can already judge if the kind of interface is ignited, the carbon is ignited there or not. So the question is, how long have you, that calculation has continued in SPH? You said momentarily carbon ignited, but then expand. But
it's my recollection. If I could pull up the video again, the time marker was up in the corner, but it was something in the order of 10 orbital periods. It's not not continued for a long time.
I think after a few minutes or 5 minutes, then the structure goes stationary, and we can judge the data evolution from that point.
It's not.
I'm going to try to provoke the audience before we break. Sorry, Roseanne, to break in, but I think the question is: do you think this turns into a carbon-burning star, or do you think it explodes as a Type 1A,
or both?
I mean a carbon-burning star. I mean, I think that the literature, many of the papers in the literature say that the merger leads to ignition of the surface, and then, like in a helium,
I think,
you get your way in, you make a carbon-burning star, not a Type 1A supernova. So I think for the observers in the crowd, they'd love to know the answer as to whether the double degenerates lead to a Type 1A or whether they lead to a carbon-burning star, because I've seen... Well, but I think the theoretical community owes some clear answers to this, so...
I mean, I can envision two circumstances. One, I argued before about trying a model with equal mass white dwarfs, and the point was that minimizes shock heating of the transferred material. If any initial conditions are going to lead to a prompt ignition deep in the white dwarf interior, it seems to be that's the case to be investigated. On the other hand, if that does not occur and you dissipate the donor into a disk, now we've got the issue, which I don't know that we're in any position to answer: what is the dissipation time scale for that disk? That's going to determine whether indeed one still ignites carbon at the surface of the accreting star, or whether that material can cool to degeneracy if it's not already degenerate and provoke carbon ignition in the interior of that accretor. In my estimation, it's an open book.
So let's break for coffee, and then we'll come back at 4 to begin the